Hello and welcome to Homestead Hens and Honey, a beekeeping, chicken keeping, and general homesteading podcast. I'm your host, Gemma, and today I am talking about my current nemesis, namely thistle, and to get really specific, Canada thistle. But before I get into that topic, I thought I'd do some quick updates on the homestead. If you follow me on Instagram, you would have seen that my more recent post was a little sort of feeling sorry for myself because I had Petal, my white frizzle, had a prolapse. So I found her with her prolapse and a lot of blood. I suspect that she started pecking at it because chickens aren't smart and they are attracted to the color red. Thankfully, I was able to manipulate the prolapse back into place, and I used honey for any of the tissue that I needed the swelling to go down on. And then I gave her chickeny painkillers and anti-inflammatories and kept her in the house for a couple of days. I gave her 50-50 odds for that very first night. She seemed shocky. And I didn't know how much blood had been lost or how much chickens can lose. I know that in much smaller bird species, such as budgies or parakeets, that any kind of blood loss can be extremely dangerous. And I've never really figured out how dangerous it is for chickens. So I gave her 50-50 and she was still with us the next day. And actually, she had shown improvement. She could poop normally. Thankfully, she has not passed another egg yet. The day that she had the prolapse, I found an egg that was hers, and I think something happened. She pushed really hard and it caused that area to start coming out. When she was in the house, after being given pain medication, I couldn't feel anything solid inside her like another egg, but she ended up laying a completely shell-less egg. So it just had that membrane around it. And maybe, I don't know if that caused her to push so hard, maybe being backed up like that with two eggs. Either way, she started to show a lot of improvement and her vent area is still a little swollen and a little bulgy, more than I would like. But I felt that because she was eating and drinking and active, that it was good to get her back outside. I also fully admit that I wanted her outside because she was attracting flies. So we're at that time of year where it gets a little drier and the flies are all over the chicken areas because they love chicken poo. So it's good food, it's good moisture for them. Flies will go wherever there is poo. And unbeknownst to me, that first day, the flies were coming in the house, going under the door to the bathroom where I set up my chicken hospital and trying to get at her chicken poo. So I opened the door to that bathroom and there's like 20, 25 flies in there. It was absolutely disgusting. And insanely, I put up fly paper and it didn't catch one single fly. So couldn't handle that. Also really couldn't handle the smell. She has always been really stinky compared to my other chickens. I mean, no chicken poop is, you know, wonderfully fragrant of rosebuds and cinnamon buns, but herself as a chicken has always been stinky. Like, I've noticed this with her before, and I don't know if it's because she's a frizzle, so her feathers don't cover and protect her body in the same way that the other chickens' feathers do, but yeah, she real stinky. So I decided to put her outside, and because I didn't want her being bullied or harassed, she went in with the babies, the little velociraptors, who are getting so much bigger now, but they're still babies and they still are nervous and they're not in the challenging phase of their growing up period. So I put her in. She immediately pecked one of them, which terrified all the others. And that made it clear that she is now queen of the velociraptors. And about 24 hours after her introduction, they were no longer super scared of her, but they clearly try and keep out of her way. And there's been no fighting. There's nothing that I could be worrying about. So that's quite good. I do check on her every day. I'm not seeing anything that concerns me so far, so fingers crossed she's going to get through this. My biggest concern is when she passes her next egg, and I don't know when that will be. So fingers crossed for my little Petal, please. Speaking of chickens, one of my English Orpingtons has gone broody. It's Bernadette. She is this beautiful black chicken with green iridescence on her feathers, very fluffy. But she doesn't seem to understand the purpose of her broodiness. And by this I mean a broody hen decides that they're going to sit on their eggs, right? And usually what happens is they choose a nest and they lay their egg there. And then they let the other chickens lay their eggs in that same nest until she has a clutch of eggs. And I'm not entirely sure what it is that makes chickens think, okay, that's enough. But they then have as many eggs as they're comfortable with, and then they stop the other chickens from coming into that nest. So they've gathered their clutch and now they're in incubation mode. Bernadette understands the I have chosen a nest box part of that, but she does not understand that she needs eggs to sit on if she wants to be a mother. So she's been sitting in the covered nest box on the floor, and she will not let any other chicken in there. And she's also far enough into her broodiness now that she's stopped laying her own eggs. So she just sits in there, making sure no other chickens can go in, and gets very upset when I check on her with no eggs. So she just doesn't seem to understand this reproduction thing. I'm just leaving her to it. Usually I kind of scoot her out. She is coming out to forage a little bit and eat. She's not a really dedicated broody yet, like I've seen with Dahlia, who's like my queen of raising the babies. So I'm going to see how things play out with her. If she starts getting kind of skinny and it's going on too long, I'll probably try and break her broodiness. We don't really need more babies right now. But I find it hilarious that she can't seem to figure out the whole, okay, you've chosen the nest, but now you need eggs if you want to have babies. Speaking of my Instagram post, you probably also saw that one of my skinks dropped her tail, and I can laugh about it now, but God, that was one hell of a Saturday morning. I'm so glad I went in when I did, and it was just utterly bizarre because I saw the tail in the water bowl and the skink in the corner. And I was kind of like, hang on, how can her tail be positioned so that it's poking out of the water like that? So I go closer and I think I realize what's happened. And it really threw me. I knew it was physically possible, but I have never had a skink lose a tail, not even a baby. And I've never seen this species anywhere where one's lost a tail aside from in the wild in Australia. I mean, not that I've been there, but I mean, like, I have seen photos of wild specimens. So I just thought that it really wasn't that much of a risk, unlike with something like a crested gecko, where they can drop their tails relatively easily and then it never grows back. So this really threw me for a loop. And at first, I was pleasantly surprised. I can't get into the whole mechanism. Maybe I should do a post or an episode on it. But basically, they constrict blood flow to the area and they have special muscle fibers that allow them to detach the tail. And it detaches cleanly. It actually breaks through it breaks right through the vertebra. There's like special, I'm going to call them fault lines that they have there. And then the muscle fibers like constrict and then disconnect. And so the tail end where it's come off her body has what looks like little petals or tentacles coming out of it, and those are the special muscle fibers, and those were perfectly clean. You know, there's no blood, there's no tearing of tissue. It was a very clean detachment. What worried me is that a chunk of about an inch and a bit had tried to disconnect from her as well. And when I examined it, it felt like it was quite firmly connected. And my concern was that if it was connected through the vertebra, that not getting her vet treatment could lead potentially to an infection that would be in her spine and obviously would therefore become very dangerous very fast. Now, part of the problem was that it's Saturday morning, my vet closes at 1, and they only accept emergency drop-offs until 11, and it was like 10 when I found this, so I had to take her in, do an emergency drop-off, pay a very large deposit, of which I got almost none of it back, and she had to stay over the weekend, in part because they're not open on Sunday, which is kind of a bugger, but okay. In hindsight, if my husband had been home, he was away at a conference, but if he'd been home as a herpetologist who's trained in animal surgery and he specializes in reptiles, he could have seen what the vet saw, which was that the chunk actually was only attached by some flesh. It was an easy removal. And then it was just a case of leaving the wound, cleaning it, not suturing. If you suture these wounds, apparently multiple tails start to regrow around the sutures, so you need to leave it open. Then doing anti-inflammatories, painkillers, and antibiotics. He could have done all that for me, and we could have saved like $500. But as it turns out, he wasn't here. I had to make a very quick decision. I don't regret it, because I would never have forgiven myself if it became an infection of the spine. And I already feel really guilty that it happened. I was cohabitating her. She lived with Hyperion. Hyperion had been with a female before, and I made him a bachelor because he got kind of aggressive with her and I didn't like how rough he was. When I put him with this female, Io, they actually got on really well. He wasn't as aggressive during breeding. They bred and he kind of backed off. He didn't damage her. He didn't harm her in any way. It seemed like she was a good match for him. Now, unfortunately, she slugged out, so she didn't produce babies for me, although there was some fertilization. And I put her back in with him because I was like, well, they're living well together. It will be fine. Well, it wasn't fine. The only thing that I can think of that happened is there's no signs of a fight on her. So there's no bite marks anywhere on her body. You can't even really see bite marks on her tail. So what we're thinking happened is that he probably was getting kind of randy. It is way too early for breeding season, but, you know, who knows with animals, right? So he was probably getting randy, and part of the whole mating dance is that they do bite the sides and tail of the female. So he was probably nibbling on her, and I think what happened is she panicked and wedged herself under the water bowl. And if he kept going at her tail, even though I couldn't see signs of damage, maybe just feeling like she was stuck where she was and him biting it, she just went, oh, I'm done with this. And she just boop, dropped the tail. And that's why. So Hyperion will forever be a bachelor now. So a moment of silence for the fact that he will never have sex again. Okay, that's about as much silence as he needs. And Io is now in a hospital tank. She's getting anti-inflammatories, painkillers, and injectable antibiotics. I'm already really good at giving those injections because I've been getting Titan through this long issue with his abscess. So now I have two skinks who get injections every couple of days. But they seem, both of them are doing really well. Titan's actually gained some weight. He looks a lot brighter. I'm just really, really pleased. I think I could probably put him back into a natural tank again. Io will be in the hospital tank until that tail starts to regrow. And I'll keep everyone updated on that process because I'm really curious to see how it looks. It's never going to look like the original one did, and it will probably be a lot shorter, but very curious to see what happens there. Whether she will be bred or not in future is up in the air right now. The priority is to get her through this process of regrowing a tail, which likely means I'm not going to pair her for this upcoming autumn, but who knows, maybe the next year. We'll see how she does. Right now, it's just about her health. Real quick before I forget, I think I mentioned on my last episode that I had that baby that went to this wonderful customer, but the baby had these weird bumps developing on its spine and it wasn't eating great, although it was active. And so I sent her a new baby and I told her to send that one that we were calling Quasimodo back. Right before he was due to come back, Quasimodo passed away. And my customer is incredible because I said, if you are comfortable can you freeze the body and then send it to me? Which she did. And we have him. And actually, my husband took the body straight to his lab because he has much better equipment there. Doing a basic necropsy on a baby that's this small, I'm not going to be able to see what I need to see. Henry has, you know, things that will help him really examine this closely and get to the nitty-gritty and see what his spine looks like and whether we can identify what is the ultimate cause. So that's sad, but I really appreciate having such a great customer, and she is in love with the new baby who is eating really well for her. In fact, he's being a little piggy. He's very active. He's very bright. So she's delighted. And that's really what I care about. Other weirdness happening on the homestead. I just realized that my sad little cucumber plant that's really been struggling against some kind of insect, I think maybe it was slugs. It's not a cucumber, it's a sunflower. And if you're wondering, Gemma, how the hell can you have been gardening and never not realized it was a sunflower? In my defense, I know the difference between a cucumber seed and a sunflower seed. And I think what happened is I put cucumber seeds in there, and they either didn't germinate or they started to grow and something ate them and then came back and buried a sunflower. So I'm really thinking chipmunk or squirrel. And in the early stages, because it was struggling so much, I really couldn't tell the difference between cucumber plant leaves and sunflower leaves. And now, though, that it's actually bigger, I realize that it's just a sunflower. So there will be no cucumbers for me this year, unless my neighbor gives me some, which is sad. But lesson learned, I'm probably going to not use cucumber seeds next year, or if I do, start them in the house and then transplant them once they're bigger and more hardy. Other sort of sad gardening news is that the Japanese beetles are back. I knew I was being cocky. I really thought we'd seen so few of them. I really thought maybe we wouldn't have to worry about them, but now they're back. My personal theory is that they're back later than usual because the milky spore that I put into the lawn has worked. But if my neighbors aren't using milky spore, their gardens will attract Japanese beetles and they will eventually migrate over and start eating all my roses. So they're just decimating my poor roses. But on the plus side, I actually got like my heirloom to bloom this year before these little bastards came in and just chewed them all up. So I'm taking it as a kind of a win, and I'm going to have to buy more milky spore and do a couple more applications in the fall to try and keep extending this period of being without Japanese beetles. I don't think I'll ever be fully without them because, like I said, my neighbors suffer with them as well and they'll just migrate. But I think I'm doing the best that I can with tools that I'm comfortable using. And on a quick personal update, I've been feeling better and brighter this past week, which is nice. It's kind of a relief, honestly. I still have a lot of stuff coming up, including that medical procedure, but I will cross that bridge when I come to it. And for now, I'm just trying to really enjoy each day and spend the time that I can with my critters and my plants and my bees, and just try not to think too far ahead about what kind of misgivings I have about various upcoming surgeries. We'll deal with it when we get there. So let's talk about thistles, those little bristly things with the purple flowers. Now, my side garden that I had landscaped last year, it has always had an issue with thistles. But it got really, really bad when during the landscaping, we'd like completely dug up that whole area. So I don't know if it just sort of churned up the seeds that might have been in the soil and brought them closer to the surface. And then also there's a kind of thistle that I'm going to talk about very soon, which has roots that it can also propagate from. So even a tiny piece of root, it can propagate from that. And so that whole bed got taken completely over by thistles in the middle of the project. And then they started moving into the lawn a little bit as well. And they've been a real challenge to manage. So while looking into how the heck do I get rid of thistle plants, the first step is identify the species so that you can target your method of attack. And in my area of Ohio, the two thistle species that I think are the most likely culprits are the Canada thistle and the bull thistle. Now, there are lots of other species of thistle that do grow here, but these two are the most likely culprits. So let's start with Canada thistle. Its Latin name is Circium arvense, and it's sometimes called California thistle, creeping thistle, field thistle, and really appropriately, cursed thistle. This thistle is cursed. It's a native plant in southeastern Eurasia, but it was brought to North America in the early 1700s, so it's been here a really long time. And it's considered a noxious weed in many states. It has naturalized in 58 of 88 counties in Ohio, so basically you will see it all over the place here. And the easiest way to identify it is by its root system, because the roots will grow downwards and horizontally. You can also look for things such as it has a relatively smooth, spineless stem. The flowers are small, lavender-coloured flower buds that can either grow as single flowered or in groups of 2 to 5. The roots can grow to a depth of 3 feet, and the stems themselves grow up to around 4 foot, but I swear I had some that were 5 foot last year. And this little bugger reproduces by seeds and a rhizomatic root system, which I will get more into in a little bit. So the other option was bull thistle, which is known as Circium vulgare, and sometimes it's called spear thistle or common thistle. Now, this is actually the national flower of Scotland, so you might be able to visualise exactly what thistle plant I'm talking about. It's naturalised in North America, Africa, and Australia, and it's native throughout Europe, Western Asia, and Northwestern Africa. Now, in the areas where it's native, and I guess here as well, because it's a good nectar producer, it's known for being a really good plant for your pollinators. It can grow to 2 to 6 foot tall, and the flower heads have a very distinctive gumdrop shape to them. It has a very interesting 2-year life cycle, so it flowers in the second year, and it reproduces by seed only. So if you have bull thistle and it's a weed for where you are, you can prevent it from spreading by preventing it from reseeding. So as I mentioned briefly, bull thistle is considered a good pollinator, particularly in areas where it's native. And we have native thistles in America as well. And they are very good for pollinators. So whenever possible, if you come across something and you think that's definitely a thistle, but I don't know what kind, it's really beneficial if you could identify it before just attacking it and getting rid of it, because there is a chance that it could be a native thistle which is going to help your local pollinators. Now, in terms of identifying thistles, this is not easy. I find the descriptions of the way the leaves and the stems look really confusing and not super helpful. I pored over even photographic ID guides for this post, and I still don't feel any more confident about IDing thistle plants. But I did come across a really, really helpful website called Weedwise, and it's a conservation program of the Clackamas SWCD. I will have a link in the website notes, so you can go to the page yourself. And they have a really good little question section. So the questions are, is this thistle spiny along the entire stem? Are the bracts, which, side note, bracts are a leaf-like structure that forms the cup around the base of the flowers. So are the bracts triangular, firm, and spine-tipped? Are the bracts thick, leathery, and jagged? And are the roots rhizomous? And if you answer no to all of those questions, you very likely have found a native thistle, which is good news. Hooray! However, chances are, if you live in an area where there are noxious weeds listed, you will probably find Canada thistle. and bull thistle listed. Now, Canada thistle is the one that I am dealing with, and it is a huge pain in the butt because, as I mentioned earlier, it propagates through seeding and through its root system. And because it's got this rhizomous root system, even a piece as small as half of a grain of white rice is all that it needs to start regenerating that root system. So it's very, very difficult to treat. When I started Googling, how do I eradicate thistle? The results were kind of all over the place. And there's two treatments that came up primarily. The first one is Preen, which is a name brand for a pre-emergent chemical herbicide, so it prevents seeds from germinating. And if you Google, does Preen work on thistles, you will find some things that say yes and some things that say no. And it turns out that they're both right. So you might already see where I'm going with this. It works on seeds. So if you have a thistle like bull thistle that only propagates through seeding, then yes, Preen is going to be very good for you. If you have Canada thistle, Preen will help with the seeds that might disperse, but if you have that root system still intact, Preen has no function on that root system at all. It will not harm it in any way. So you will still be dealing with the Canada thistle. So Preen's active ingredient, the actual herbicide part of it, is called trifluralin, okay? And like I said, it prevents seeds from germinating. That's why it's called a pre-emergent. So it really only works on the seeds in the soil. Once they start to grow, it doesn't have an effect on them. So if you see weeds and you put Preen down, it's not going to kill those weeds. You need to get those weeds out, then put the Preen down. Now, Preen is marketed predominantly for lawn care, so getting weeds out of your lawn and getting it out of garden beds, but it does offer a variety labelled specifically for use in vegetable gardens, so that is an option. All of my neighbours use Preen. They always ask me, Gemma, do you know what Preen is? It might help with your weeds. And so here is what I say. Why don't I use Preen? Because clearly it sounds great. It's going to stop all these weeds from their seeds from germinating. It's a great preventative. So why am I not using it? I don't use it because the very first time that I Googled the active ingredient, I learned that it had been banned in the European Union since 2004 because of the tremendously negative impact it had on marine and freshwater life. So it is toxic to fresh and saltwater fish, amphibians and snails. I think even here in the US, where obviously it's allowed to be used, it will say on the label, don't use by waterways. So don't use it by rivers and lakes and ponds and things like that, because it's very bad once it gets into the water for these like delicate species. So that's why I don't use Preen, because I want to do this naturally. I don't want to harm all of my froggy amphibian friends. Oh, speaking of, we have tadpoles in the pond for the first time ever, and they're tiny. They're like the tiniest little tadpoles. I'm so excited. I'll keep you updated on what they turn into, because I'm hoping I'll get to see their adult phase and know what they are. But anyway, so I don't use Preen because I'm a big softie and I want to protect my local amphibians. I could say, and I almost have when I'm getting frustrated, well, all my neighbours use Preen and our whole area floods a lot. And we still have quite a lot of frogs. So it's obviously not like a drop of it is going to kill everything. But I just can't. We flood so much. And my drainage runs right through that bed and then it goes right down into the drains. And I just can't. So I'm not using it. What I did find, however, is there is an alternative. There is an alternative to Preen that is not going to harm amphibians. And that is corn gluten. Sometimes it's listed as corn gluten meal. And it acts as a pre-emergent, but it acts through a different mechanism. So whereas the Preen active ingredient prevents seeds from germinating, corn gluten meal, it can't prevent germination, but it inhibits root growth. So if a seed is trying to grow roots and it can't, then eventually it's going to die. And that's how the corn gluten works. Apparently it works on most weeds as well as crabgrass. Still don't really know what crabgrass is. It's a very American thing. If someone pointed at it and said, look, crabgrass, I'd be like, okay. What is it? No, I know what it is. It is a kind of noxious grass or whatever, but I've never been able to identify different kinds of grass. It's all very strange to me. But anyway, corn gluten application is tricky because timing is very important. So when you apply it, you either need to water immediately or you need to apply it right before rain. However, after that initial wettening of it, it then needs a few dry days to work most effectively on the seeds. So looking at your weather, trying to figure out, you know, if I apply it now, is the rain going to clear up? Do I have enough dry days? That can be tricky. The good news, though, is that it's has a cumulative effect. So results will improve with subsequent applications. The only sort of thing to consider with it is it seems like you need a fair amount of the product to work effectively, and obviously the timing issue, but also it does increase the nitrogen level in your soil. So if you have plants that, I don't know, are going to go completely bonkers if there's too much nitrogen or will be harmed by too much nitrogen, then it's something that you would need to consider. So I said when you're looking at ways to combat thistle, two main things come up, and one is preen and the other is Roundup. Now, the active ingredient in Roundup is glyphosate. I think that's how you say it. If not, I apologize in advance. Glyphosate, and this is a broad spectrum systemic herbicide and crop desiccant. Now, it was discovered by a Monsanto chemist in 1970, and then it was brought to the market for agricultural use in 1974 under the name Roundup. So usually people will use the chemical name glyphosate and Roundup interchangeably because Roundup is the brand best known. It's been on the market the longest. It was the original use of this herbicide. Now, this herbicide works by it targets a specific enzyme pathway in plants, and this enzyme pathway is called the shikimic acid pathway. And if you use Roundup, it will work on the thistles and it will kill the roots. So if you have Canada thistles, it will effectively kill all the way down to the root system. When my designer for the landscape area was talking to me about what I could do with the thistle, and she recommended Roundup, and I told her, no, I don't use Roundup because I'm worried about runoff and I'm worried about the impact it will have on my bees and local pollinators. Now, she suggested a method that I think is pretty ingenious. I still won't use it because I really don't want to use Roundup, but I thought this was a good idea for anyone out there who is desperate. So what she recommends is get some old kitchen sponge and cut it in half and then glue it to tongs, so like barbecue tongs. And what you do is you dip the sponges into the Roundup or like spray a little bit on it, and you go out and you use the tongs with the sponges to clamp the visible part of the thistle, so that the stem that's coming out of the ground. And that will very quickly kill the thistle and all the way down. And then you can just dig it up and get rid of it, or just, you know, pull it out. And it minimizes runoff because you're not spraying. And you can time when you do this to, you know, very early in the morning before a lot of plants are out and about. This is Gemma, the edit fairy. Did I just say when plants are out and about? As far as I'm aware, plants are always out unless they're dead or under the soil growing tough little bulbs. So what I meant to say here was you can apply it very early in the morning when bees and other pollinators aren't out yet. And now I return you to your regularly scheduled episode. Or very late in the evening, whichever one works for you. And I think that's very smart. I really, really do. And if I got really desperate, I might consider it. But I really, 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 really hate Roundup. And I have endless guilt because before I learned about the active ingredient in it, I had a bottle that I used briefly. So now I have this bottle sitting in my garage and it brings me shame every time I see it. And I also don't know how I'm going to get rid of it. Can you safely dispose of it? How would I do that? Or is it literally going to be with me until I die and someone else has to deal with it? Who knows? But here's why I hate it. Glyphosate remains in soil for varying amounts of time. And it seems like if you really look into the papers on this, no one can agree on how long it stays in the soil. It also can contaminate waterways. So there's the runoff that I mentioned earlier. So let's say you spray things, it rains, it goes down into the soil, on the surface of the soil, it gets washed away into various waterways where it causes harm to the plants there, as well as like small animals, like fish and things like that. It has been connected to detrimental effects in honeybees and native pollinators, particularly bumblebees. It's a suspected carcinogen. Now, this point about whether it's a carcinogen or not, I'm very like, about, because I mainly don't like it because of its effect on bees. And I'm about it being a carcinogen because no one can agree. I looked at a couple of different papers, some of which say absolutely not a carcinogen. There's no concern about it. Just don't let it get in your eyes. Like the most damage it will do is if it makes contact with your eyes. And then others say, well, we think at these amounts over time, it did increase risks of certain cancers. And it's gone back and forth like this for years. So really, my thing would be avoid Roundup because of how it harms bees. I'm not really so sure about whether it can cause cancer in mammals. Now, as I mentioned, glyphosate targets that specific enzyme pathway found in plants, the shikimic acid pathway. And this very specific pathway that it targets is also used by some bacteria, including bacteria found in the microbiome of honeybees. And as a result, this reduces beneficial gut bacteria, which leaves bees vulnerable to pathogens and premature death. And then on top of that, in a very interesting and also very horrifying discovery, the inert ingredients found in Roundup are also extremely problematic for bees. So the inert ingredients are anything aside from the glyphosate, but specifically the use of wetting agents called surfactants. And I found this really interesting paper. It was by researchers at Royal Holloway, University of London, where they took different versions of Roundup, including one that doesn't have glyphosate in it, and they tested the effect that these different versions had on bumblebees. Their findings were published in the Journal of Applied Ecology, and the short version is that they found that mortality rates were greater than 90% in bumblebees for almost for all of the different versions of Roundup. And even the glyphosate-free version, it killed 96% of the exposed bumblebees. It seems like they're not entirely sure why the surfactants are causing this level of mortality. But one of the theories is that they might be suffocating bees by blocking or disrupting their tracheal system. I also found references in various news media articles to glyphosate damaging larvae in honeybees, and even doing things like interrupting honeybee communication by impeding the use of their senses, but I haven't been able to track down any papers on it. And as I have fallen in the habit of, I'm recording this the day before it goes live, so I've kind of run out of time. So for now, I'm going to say, take that with a grain of salt, and I'll keep working on tracking down those papers and dig into them a bit more and find out what has been discovered, if anything, about that particular issue with honeybees. Okay, so what can I do about noxious thistles? So my options are to use preen, which might help in part, but not if I have Canada thistle, or glyphosate, which I think I've made a pretty strong case for why I will not use that. So what are my options? Do I just give up? Is my garden going to become a thistle paradise? No. So even if you're dealing with a double whammy like the Canada thistle, so it's propagating through seed and its rhizomous roots, your best bet is to both prevent it from seeding and weaken the root system. And you can weaken the root system by not letting it grow particularly large. So when it's just, you know, a couple of inches above the soil, you can pull, dig, or even just cut those thistles. The younger they are, the better. And this prevents them from building a robust root system because they need the above ground part of the plant to generate the energy to feed the root system. So if you let those thistles grow to full size, your root system is going to be so much bigger and stronger and harder to get rid of. So it's really just a case of going out there and getting rid of those thistles the minute you see them. If you come across an area that, I don't know, you just got to and they've already flowered, you need to cut the heads off, put them in a plastic bag, which I don't really like to use plastic, but I don't know what else you could use here. And then that goes in your trash bin. So you don't want those flowers in your compost. You want them to go deep into a landfill when they get picked up by the garbage man. You really, really, really never want to let the flowers go to seed because they are windblown. So they will blow pretty much everywhere and you'll find that you will have a lot more to deal with the next year. Now, you could use a pre-emergent to get any seeds that have made it to the soil to stop them from growing. So you could use preen or you could use the corn gluten. But again, this isn't going to do anything for the roots. So you'd need to also be the digging and cutting and so forth. I also read some stuff that said if you grow cover plants that create heavy shade, this can help force the thistles out because Canada thistles in particular don't do well in shade, particularly heavy shade. And you want to look for cover plants ideally that are going to outcompete the growth rate of the thistle. So those cover plants are going to spread faster than the thistle is able to, which hopefully will continue to push that thistle out of your garden. You can also use things like landscape fabric, plastic covers or mulch, which gross. I don't use plastic in my garden when I can avoid it, or very heavy mulching, which is the route that I'm going. So you dig everything up, put down your pre-emergent if you want to, and then put down either, you know, a thick layer of mulch or landscape fabric. And this will hopefully prevent further growth. But, and here's the thing that I'm trying to remind myself of. If you're looking at getting rid of Canada thistle and you really don't want to use herbicides, so basically if you're me, it can take 2+ years of diligent pulling and digging and mulching to really get a handle on the issue and to rid your garden of this weed. So I have a lot of work ahead of me. I'm in the thick of it right now. But at least there's hope. It's a lot of work and it's going to take a long time, but there's hope. So that's my episode on thistle and why it's driving me insane right now. I'm going to post the list of references, so websites that I used while putting this episode together. And they're all be in the episode description. So in particular, I want to say I used Weedwise from the conservationdistrict.org, deepgreenpermaculture.com. They had a very, very interesting article on how to neutralize glyphosate contamination. So if you have drift that hits plants that are damaged by it, but which you didn't want to kill with it, they have some really interesting tips and tricks there, and it's just a very good article. I also, whenever I could, I linked to the abstract of any of the scientific articles that I mentioned. Those are found on things like bestjournals.onlinelibrary, science.org, and sciencedirect.org. sciencedirect.com. So I'll put all those links in the episode description so you can go and read them for yourself and decide whether I interpreted them correctly, I suppose. All right, so that's what we have. I don't really have anything else to say. This went on way longer than I intended it to. I will not be back next week. Next week is my birthday. Yes, the whole week is my birthday. My birthday's on the 28th, so I'm probably not going to be recording the day before or any time really next week unless like a bolt of inspiration hits me. And then that weekend, we're doing some birthday fun, like the Renaissance Fair, and I'm going to get dressed up for it. And you know, we've got some dinners out, and it's just, I'm really, really looking forward to it. So I'm not going to be prioritizing getting an episode done, but hopefully in 2 weeks, I'll be back with, I really hope I'll be back with news of a honey harvest and how my bees are doing. So fingers crossed for that. So until next time, I hope you are all healthy and happy and enjoying the weather. I hope it's not baking you into a crisp. I keep seeing the news about us reaching record highs this July all across the world. So I hope you're wearing your sunscreen. And I will be back I'll be back in 2 weeks. And as always, remember, hug your hens and then wash your hands. Thank you so much for listening. Bye-bye.